stand over this microphone here and I'm going to hit record. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
Lucky last. I should say tape identification. This is another installment in the Muruba series of Indigenous oral histories for Sydney World Pride. The date is the 20th of February 2023, after the launch of Sydney World Pride, and I'm with Ginny Jane Smith. Now, Ginny, do I call you Ginny or Ginny Jane? JJ! Ginny! I like Ginny. I love the name Ginny. Could you introduce yourself as fully as you would like, how you like to be known, how you like to be identified?
Walwani, my name is Ginny Jane. I'm a proud Wiradjuri Walbunja woman from the Yuin Nation. I am a mother and auntie to many, but I'm a staunch black lesbian woman. And I've been around for a bit, big note myself, is what I like to call it, just to make sure that there is representations of me.
And where are you professionally? Give us a sense of your kind of where you've worked and what you're driven to do in your life.
Sure. So, I was a stereotypical Mountie County girl. I was a teen mum, and becoming a teen mum then made me want to be passionate and true to myself in being my most authentic self. I was a teen mum to a beautiful girl who is now 21, so I have adult children. My first career move after having my baby was with Women's Legal Service. So I was kind of thrown in with a whole heap of, feminist women. I wouldn't say feminist women, but just women who are passionate about women's issues. And that kind of put me on the trajectory of advocacy for mob and ensuring that mob's voices were heard. Being a queer woman, being a lesbian woman, it's always been my passion to ensure that young people are seen as well as heard, rather than the old narrative of you to be seen but not heard. I made sure that I was very loud and proud, and I've been an advocate for women's issues, youth issues, especially within our Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander communities. So I did most of my work have always been around that, and then I moved into Redfern. Like, I have family history being a part of Redfern, but then I moved into Redfern myself with my daughter, changing career and following my career choices, still doing black youth issues mainly and women's issues. So I'm on the board of Mudjingal Aboriginal Women's Centre here in Redfern. I'm also on the board of Koori Radio, where I was once working as the Young Black and Deadly coordinator. I then, wanted to get more passionate. I'm also the co-chair of the Aboriginal Advisory Panel for City of Sydney. My actual job now is I'm the Aboriginal team leader for ACON. ACON's a peak organisation that has been supporting the LGBTIQ community for many, many years, and I head up the Aboriginal project and still recruiting, looking for more people to come work with me about this work that we do, supporting queer mob. So I worked with ACON a few years ago, and I've always been a part of the Mardi Gras float committees since like 2008. And every year around this time, we would always, after these, with the workshops and stuff of building the float, there would always be this yarn of what are we going to do now? Now that we don't have, a purpose to meet up every weekend working on the float and stuff. So me and a couple of other friends, two other brother boys of mine who, were good friends, sat down on the top of Koori Radio and said, right, well, we need to start an organisation that supports our LGBTIQ community. And that's when the conversation first began around creating the organisation Black, BLAQ. So myself, Will Trulin and Jonathan Aliha were the initial creators of Black, and that is now a peak organisation supporting the LGBTIQ community. I'm back at ACON helping our community. So we're just kind of like That's my little work resume in a little nutshell about me and what I do and where the passion comes from. But I mean, like, what more do you want to know after hearing all of that?
That's a lot. But where, if I guess, if you know, we're talking about oral history, and that's our lives and the trajectory of our lives as we understand it. Where would your story begin? Where were you? I guess people begin when I was, where I was born, and what year I was born. But where did life begin?
Well, life began for me probably here on the block. You know, Mum and Dad met here in Redfern. They actually lived, you know, on Caroline Street, where I am apparently. Like, they was down, like, this was their, where they lived.
Crazy.
I know, right?
And you're living now in one of the Tower, Pemulwuy Tower building here, yeah, on Caroline and corner Caroline and Everly.
Yeah, exactly. And when we first moved in here, one of the uncles said to me, said, that's where your mum and dad used to live, you know. So yeah, Mum and Dad met here through the movement, when things were happening back in the 70s and 60s. And you know, dad was a bit of a, he was an influencer. Dad was a famous actor who passed, and he was a very much an advocate. My grandparents were also, you know, advocates and were a part of Native Title, always been a part of the movement, always been passionate about blackfella issues. So for me, you know, like, life pretty much started here in Redfern and on the block. And you know, then when having my daughter, and then I wanted for things to be different for her as well, which is what my parents wanted for me. So that's what really, that's where it began, I would say, you know.
And your dad by name, Uncle Kevin Smith?
Yes.
Uncle Kevin Smith.
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that
bit. You didn't know that? Yeah, so that's my dad. He, last movie he ever did, because we lost him a few years ago, last movie he ever did was Jindabyne. It's dedicated in memory of him. We lost him during editorial for that. But he was more famous for his stage plays, and he was a brilliant actor. He was, yeah, so I often say that I'm just an actor's daughter. I'm not an actor, but, you know, you ask my partner, she says otherwise.
Well, it's impossible to avoid taking on some of their, I mean, actors create generally, unless they're really, they're monsters, and we do have a, there's a whole history of actors who are monsters in their family lives, but they create children who are strident and speak their mind and don't feel fear around speaking out.
Definitely. And, you know, being, I was the youngest girl out of all of Dad's kids. So I was pretty much a daddy's girl. And I did have the right to say what I wanted to. And I had the backing from him. you ask my siblings, they would say, she did. but yeah, he did empower me to speak my mind. And, you know, he gave me strength to make wise decisions around, you know, where my trajectory of life will be and what I would do about it and what is important to be, you know, staunch black woman as well. Like, you know, my sexuality, when I first came out to him, it wasn't an issue. My mum had an issue. But, you know, my dad's younger brother was one of the first men to, you know, contract HIV and then pass of AIDS in 1994, and he was 24. And in the you know, like, there was a period there where Dad actually moved in with him when he was sick in Surry Hills, and was, you know, helping him and stuff before he actually went home and had to be taken a bit more care of. But you know, Dad was actually, you know, that was his baby brother. Dad was the eldest, and that was his baby brother, and he loved his baby brother, and, you know, wanted to protect him and stuff. So yeah, you know, like, seeing that, and then when I, with my story of coming out, my dad really didn't have an issue. Like, it was just like, oh, okay, cool, moving on.
As an actor, perhaps he'd already come to terms with, or as much as straight people need to come to terms with us, but you know what I mean? Like, he'd already confronted it and dealt with it. Like, people in the Navy, men in the Navy know, yeah, this happens, like, no big deal.
Yeah, yeah, and I think you're right, you know, like, because Dad was always surrounded by, you know, people of our community, it wasn't an issue for him, whereas, and I also do believe, too, that it comes down to the fact that because they were, like, you know, they didn't really live in a reserve or a mission or anything like that. They moved with the seasonal work, running from government pretty much. Well, not running, but like moving away from government to ensure that dad, because dad being the oldest, dad and all the kids were looked after and stuck together, that there was no government intervention with them. And so then that meant that he was more connected to culture and land and that family unity. And then, you know, whereas my mum grew up, like she was from Griffith, so she ended up having to go to the convent and she lived on a mission. And then there was the Christianity.
Inculcation.
Yeah, you know, so I think for mum, like that's where a lot of her kind of not understanding came from, whereas dad, there really wasn't an issue with, you know, what was going on. It was like, oh, is this your friend? I was like, no, Dad, that's my girlfriend. Oh, okay, cool. Nice to meet you. Like,
dealt with it, move on.
Yeah, moving on. It wasn't an issue, so yeah.
Mm. Now, so in your, I guess, in your family, immediate, I would say immediate, but, you know, family's always big. Did you grow up with all brothers and sisters around, or was it a different kind of arrangement?
Yeah, so dad has 8 children all up now. We found another one only like 2 years ago, I think, and there was another. Anyway, that was dad. He was an actor, did a lot of travelling. But mum and dad actually had 4. So I have an older brother, older sister, and then a younger brother with mum and dad. With dad, I have 3 older sisters, 1 older brother, and 2 younger brothers, or 3 younger brothers, sorry. So yeah, big family, but always had them around, and very close to my dad's family. All of dad's siblings' kids, like my first, they were brothers and sisters as well. So we grew up very close, you know, often would go home to Mogo and hang out and all the rest of it, and still do, still very close.
And then in Radri on mum's side, Ewan Walbunja. Now, Walbunja must be a clan of Ewan?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So what about Wiradjuri side? You spend much time out there, and I mean, a lot of Wiradjuri here in Redfern, much part of the, you know, like the movement, and so you feel at home anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And no, I didn't spend a lot of time out in Griffith because a lot of the family was here. Exactly. So, I've got a cousin across the hall, you know, like on my Wiradjuri side.
In this building,
yeah.
We are everywhere.
Yeah, true. So, I was very close to my nan, my mum's mum, and she was actually here as well. So she lived here for many years. She was part of AMS and stuff. So every time nan would come up, she would stay with me and we'd do things and stuff like that. So, like, I didn't feel the need to be on country there. I do go there, but I just didn't feel the need to be there as much.
We should never feel guilty about not being on country. It's not our fault. So how it is. Take a break, yeah. You're a busy woman. We shouldn't feel guilty about not being on country. It's not our fault. And we were dispersed, we were missionized. And then Sydney became this kind of place where you'd find family and people would come together. There's no shame in not being on country.
True.
So, what came first? You leaving home or coming out?
Probably leaving home, independent, staunch black woman at the age of 5. I was out of there by the time I was 14, doing my thing, you know. And then as I said, I was a teen mum. So then, you know, I had my own place before my baby was even born. Like, I just made moves. I wasn't here in Sydney, mainly Mount Druitt. Before I then moved me and my baby in here in 2008. She was still in primary school then. I think she was in year 2 at the time. And then she did her education here in Redfern, and she's got her own place now. She got her own puppy dogs and man and everything else, doing her own thing, leaving me alone.
That's a good thing. So I guess you talked about your mum not you know, perhaps not, or taking longer to accept who you were. Did she come to a place of acceptance?
Yeah, she did. It took her a while, you know, because she didn't understand it. And at the end of the day, she was upset. But like, this is my life. I'm gonna do what I'm gonna do, and as long as I'm safe and look after my responsibilities, it's not anybody else's issue, and definitely not my mum's to talk about what I'm doing in my bed. You know, like my mum. That's another thing. You know, like. But yeah, she learned to accept it. I mean, like, it's been many years now. You know, it's not a phase, which was the conversation that was had when I first came out was, oh, it's a phase. She'll get over this soon. And it's like, there still ain't no boyfriends coming around.
No prospect of it.
No.
So being you know, a lesbian and being a mother, I mean, you're not the only person I've talked to in the project who was in that. Who are those things? A lesbian and a mother. Was there any? How did you negotiate that kind of, like? I guess people think of us as being solo and having no attachments and being, yeah. Yeah, but like, that's not how, black fellas are not like that. I've certainly got a lot of attachments. I don't have any biological children, but I've got nieces and nephews we're right. responsible for.
Yeah. For me, like, I was always a mum first. Mm. And I remember yarning with one of my sister girls many years ago when my baby was still in prime school, and she was like, no, but you're a woman first, sis. And I couldn't even see myself as that, you know, like, because for me, I was a mum, so I had responsibilities that I needed to ensure that my baby was taken the best care of and given the most wholesome life to ensure that she grows up to be a kind, well-rounded, respectful person, you know, like, so that was my main goal in life. And, you know, I only got complimented on her respect for elders and stuff just like 2 nights ago. It was like, oh, thank you, I really appreciate that, you know, because like, she's no longer under my wing. She's like doing her own thing, flying solo, and like, people are still saying she's such a respectful young person, and I'm just like, okay, love that for you. But that was my goal, like, so being solo and being a single mum, like, my daughter refers to me as being a single mum with her, but I did have girlfriends. However, you know, me and her life was before my relationships.
So when you came to, I guess, your own self-realization about who you were and your sexuality, she was there.
There. She was already there. Yeah, yeah.
So I guess, how did it happen that you realized that this was the way you were? That it was not going to change. It's no phase. This is it now.
Well, she was like, I think she was about 18 months when I got my first girlfriend, and I was in that relationship for 5 years, and like, Wanjana was already there. So like, she's grown up with me only being with girlfriends. She has a relationship with her dad. However, I've always been in relationships with women. So I was in that relationship for 5 years. Look, when I speak about myself, I often say that I'm a back-to-back monogamous idiot. So long-term relationships I've been in, I mean, like, there was a relationship that I was in for 7 years, and for 6 of those years, me and my partner didn't live together, because that was, me and my daughter had our own place, and she had her own place, and, you know, although we was in a relationship with each other, we still had our own kind of separate things, because again, like, my daughter's priorities and needs came first. Mm. Yeah,
so that's a big step for anyone to take, and you know, if the world were different, you would have your partner living with you. Yeah, so that was, you know what I mean, like, I don't know, I guess there's an acceptance of heterosexuality and what is considered to be heteronormative. So yeah, I mean, we have to make all these accommodations, even though you're saying your daughter had to be always have stability and know that your life with her was the most important thing. I guess if the world was different, you would have been maybe married to that partner. I don't know. I'm not always thinking marriage is a good thing, but yeah, just always thinking about how we accommodate the world and its homophobia.
And in saying that, I was actually a vote no in regards to marriage equality.
How come?
Because my Aboriginality needed to be saw first within this country before my sexuality. Like, I can be in a 7-year relationship with the woman that I love, but I don't have to have a piece of paper to say that we are legally bound to each other. But society and the systemic racism within Australia needs to stop killing my people and needs to stop stealing our kids. And, you know, there are so many priority listed things for me before my sexuality, you know, like, and before marriage and before any of that. So I was actually pretty vocal in regards to, because I was asked to speak at a rally for marriage equality representing black lesbian women, and I said, yeah, no, I'm good. Good luck with that. And I would like to see you mob at the next Black Lives Matter rally or the next, you know, movement for our people. But, yeah, you can have that one. And then I ended up voting yes in the end because I was like, okay, cool, this is it. If we can do it, let's do it. However, it's not... I didn't do it for myself, really. I did it for the rest of the society that would love to be able to marry the one that they love.
So many things to confront in this country with all of its all of the lies that have been told and the way it runs. Sometimes I think, you know, we're putting the cart before the horse. That's one example. But I voted yes because I felt, you know, we couldn't suffer another defeat. It would be demoralising to all of us if it went that way just on the face of it, just as a box-ticking exercise. Yeah. For me, it had to be yes, because whether I agreed with or wanted to get married was beside the point.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. Like, it was bigger than us, individual. Like, although I was angry at the fact that, like, we're presented with this when we have so much more to do within our country. All right, I'll get on the bandwagon. Let's do it. Like, I'm not too convinced in regards to the next referendum, though, but that's a whole nother story.
Yeah, it's becoming crunch time, and I guess we'll have to just decide when we know more about it. Difficult one. So, yeah, in the story of your life, where do we kind of go next? I mean, what, you know, you're raising up this baby and, you know, you've just been told that this one is, you know, proud and does the right thing, and you've clearly done something right. So, you know, what do you think was most important in raising up a respectful, you know, black fella who understands how to be a black fella in the world?
Understanding culture first and foremost, understanding the systemic issues for our country, but always coming from a place of love, regardless of the decision, I think is probably one of the biggest things that I think that I instilled in her. And I don't know, with my current partner, we're actually raising her nephew. So we've got a 17-year-old boy, which is different. But, you know, he's gone to school, he's gone to work, he's got his license, he's doing all these amazing things. So I must know how to do something right, I don't know.
They're fundamentally different, aren't they? Like, girls, you know, in a way, teenagers are doing hard work. But yeah, there's the subtle differences between, say, a male child and a female child. Not talking in binaries, but just there are just things that are different ways of kind of understanding the world and moving in it.
Well, emotional support for them, you know what I mean? Because like, they have different experiences, and that's why I think that lesson of always coming from a place of love is probably the most important when it comes to society and kids in general. You know what I mean? Like, if we can come from a place of love and understanding. To help make better decisions. One of my biggest catch cries to these young people is always, whenever they're leaving to go out or whatever, I'm always like, wise choices. Because at the end of the day, those wise choices, you have to live with them. So if you make wise choices, well, then you can't go back on where you're at. You know what I mean? Like, because stand by your conviction. If that, if you believe in that, and you made a wise choice or a dumb choice, well, then you have to stand by that, because I teach you every day to make wise ones. So think about it.
And when they're on their own and they're independent and moving in the world as an independent person, I guess it's incumbent on them to take responsibility for what they do.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Because you can't control what those decision that decision making process once they're out the door. Look out. So, when your dad passed, you how old were you? 14?
No. When dad passed, I was 20. I would have been 22 at the time. Yeah, 22. I'm pretty sure. Yeah, it was after, because it was just after my 21st. So yeah, 22 I was when he passed. And Wantana, my baby, she was 4 or 5. She was just about to go into school.
Wantana. Oh, like from over there. Oh wow, that's big name there.
Yeah. So dad went over there because dad had family over there and went through some initiations and stuff over there, and he came back with the name Mandara for my eldest brother. And well, he didn't come back with that name. The story goes, this is mum's version of events, they was living in Melbourne and dad was supposed to finish business over there, but he come back because mum was pregnant with my brother, and then
men's business.
Yeah. And then they come looking for him. And then when they come, they said, all right, you're pregnant with a boy. When that boy's born, you bring him home and finish business. When dad passed, them old fellas was there at his funeral. They come down to Mogo.
Are we talking Kimberley mob?
Yeah. You know, coming to see him, send him off, which was a blessing for our family. But yeah, so that's that connection that we have with that. And my younger brother is actually named Wanjin. And Wanjana is named after, is named after him.
Yeah, this powerful creator spirit, ancestral spirit. Yeah, I don't know how I could never have that name. It's just too much expectation. I love the name Ginny. I don't know why I'm coming back to this, but Ginny Jane's quite an unusual kind of hyphenated name.
Yeah, and dad named me because I'm... Out of all of his babies, I think I was probably one of the darkest ones. And I was his little black gin. And, you know, I was part of that reclamation. And Jane is predominant within both my grandmother's names. So Ginny Jane was...
The two grandmothers and
then... Yeah.
The little black gin.
Yes, exactly. So, yeah, that's my understanding of where my name came from is... He's from a place of love again, you know. And everybody, it's like, Ginny Jane, wow. And, everybody gives me that reaction. It's like, that is such a deadly name.
I had an auntie Jenny too. It's actually Jenny. Always pronounced Ginny.
Oh.
And I understand, you know, Gin, you know, it's a, Gadigal, Yorta, Darug word for woman. That's where we come from. Where else can we go? I guess I'm thinking about, you know, what are the things that in that path of your life, I mean, did you become more of an advocate? Did you become, or have you always been, you know, activist minded or activist oriented? Have you always seen injustice and then most of us do as blackfellas, see what's wrong and then think, what can I do to make it better?
Definitely, you know, I have a year 7 education. I dropped out of year 7, you know, and it was mainly because having an argument with the history teacher in regards to what the true history is, and then it's like, well, that's not what I've been taught.
Can you tell me more about that episode?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, as the classic blackfellow story our age, I think, would say, you know, was at school in the history teachers trying to teach Australian history, and it's with the lies, and I was like, that's not true. That's not what happened when Captain Cook got here. Like, you know, and I would, you know, I would question the teachings, and it would end up being...
School here in Redfern?
No, Mount Druitt, Ridley Hill. I went to Ridley Hill High, and Yeah, that was one of the...
Still a very, very largest Aboriginal population anywhere in Western Sydney. I mean, still, they're still teaching you erroneous history.
Yeah, yeah. That's what they was doing, and I questioned it. And
what year was that, you reckon?
Oh, that was in the 90s. I'm 40 now, so... Oh, yeah, back in the 90s. I think it was 1993, maybe? 94, I don't know. Whatever that mathematical thing turns out to be.
Answer that equation.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, 1993, though, big year, you know. Mabo decision, you know, Keating gives a Redfern speech in
93. 94.
Yeah. And you're the world's Indigenous people. All this stuff happening there. Mm. 92, I think, was Mabo decision. So was it a continuous series of history lessons that really... kind of led you to turn your back on education, or was it just one episode where he was telling lies about Captain Cook?
I think that was just the straw that broke the camel's back in regards to it. We was always being fed the lies from the educational system. Being my father's daughter, who was an advocate, Dad had us at rallies, Mum and Dad had us at rallies. We was hearing blackfella, we was having the coffee table yarns, you know, breakfast table yarns around true black history and what systemic barriers were there for us. So, you know, I was kind of like homeschooled on like Black Panther life, you know, like
and then to go to school and be someone else or to subscribe to beliefs that you know are just wrong is an impossibility.
Yeah, definitely, you know. So I don't think it would have taken long before that argument was happened and that I was done dealing with the education system and, you know, started my own career and stuff. But the more that I actually got educated around working and like the systems that happen within society, the more I became stronger in, well, not so much stronger, but like became wanting to be more involved with creating change for the betterment of community. Because if I can utilise the way that I speak, the way that I write, the work that I've done or can do to make it better or to create change, well, then that's what I would love to do.
Did you have any kind of problems as a result of pulling out of school? I mean, I imagine that, there's compulsory leaving age, you know, where you have to be 15 or whatever it is. Did they come after you and your parents because you weren't in school?
So Mum and Dad had split up and Dad moved back into Redfern and Mum had us out at Mount Rudy Hill. So, you know, I wasn't really at home once I left school. I was like telling Mum that I'm coming to see Dad and I was telling Dad that I was going home to Mum, but I was just doing my own thing, you know, like, and that's it sent me on that trajectory of, you know, mucking up drugs, alcohol, and then becoming a teen mum. So that was that's where it all went.
I mean, those things, they're kind of almost a necessary part of life, because I think that's when you learn what you're not going to do, how you're not going to live. Was there a big moment where you just said, that's it, no, look out? Was it when that baby came along, or when did you work out that was not a way of life, the life that you possibly were leading?
Definitely when I fell pregnant. With Wanjana's dad, he actually got sent to rehab as a part of, like, his bail conditions. I thought I was in love with this man, bless. So I went with him. It's the best thing ever. And we went into rehab together, and then I turned 18 in the rehab, and then I left him, got sober, left him, came back out, and then realised that I was pregnant with my baby. And it was like, okay, now I have even a bigger decision to make, because once I got sober, I knew that I didn't want to be in a relationship with a man. But then I realised that I'm pregnant. It was like, okay, we got this. And, you know, me and my daughter had this. Like I said, I got with my first lesbian relationship when she was 18 months. So, you know, it was pretty much the first time that I went out to party. That I found and met someone that I was like, okay, let's do this. But yeah, you know, like I had to finish with my pregnancy and make sure that my baby was healthy and before
those things,
first things first, you know. So yeah, of course, like having her or becoming her mum was the reason for change.
And babies come along, and they're either peacemakers or they're great teachers.
Mm.
Without even being in the world and having words, they're not even verbal yet. They don't even be born, but they do. They teach us a lot.
Mm.
And so it sounds like Wanjana taught you what you needed to be and how you needed to be to keep her alive, keep her safe.
Yes, definitely. And I say that to her all the time. You know, when she was a Mughal teen, she used to use it against me.
Mughal mean wild.
Yeah. When she was a wild teenager, she would, you know, because I always had said to her, you know, that she's the reason I am the woman I am today, you know, like without becoming her mum, I wouldn't have probably made the wise choices that I've made to be where I'm at and to be successful, to be passionate, to be... Lots of people are trying to call me a leader these days, but I'm still like, there's still a lot more that I need to do for our community before I would consider myself that. I'm more of a let's get the job done together type person. I can create it. He's got to help me build it though, you know?
And leadership is something that we never accept for ourselves because I think our structure, Blackfellow Way, is you get tapped on the shoulder and then there's also a sense that you have reached an age sometimes. Unfortunately, it sometimes seems to be age-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that reluctance to take on something you haven't been expressly asked to in our way. I mean, do you think there's a moment you will go, you know, maybe it's one of the elders here will say, now time for you.
Mm.
Don't hesitate to call yourself a leader. Do you think there's a ritual that has to happen yet?
I think so. You know, and like I'm saying that there is a lot of people that are saying that, you know, they really are appreciative of my leadership. However, I do think that, I mean, like, especially with what I'm doing with the First Nations float, because that's one of my big remits of work with ACON is producing the First Nations float for Mardi Gras. And we're doing big things. And
will we lead the parade this year?
Yeah.
We always lead the parade,
well, yeah.
Since a certain time.
Yeah. So Dykes on Bikes and then us, we're doing a big 20-metre long rainbow serpent. You've heard about it, Dudley. Well, that's all my idea. and
it's a bit like a Chinese, like the Chinese dragons they have through New Year's and people underneath it.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit more about it. I think it's going to be quite memorable.
Yeah, it is. You know, everybody's really G'd about it. But yeah, it's so she's going to have her name. We've named her. She is a girl. So Matt Stegg.
Matt Stegg's involved.
Yeah.
You know, works with Justin Shoulder, incredible artist, designer. Matt's incredible.
Yeah, so I was fortunate enough to meet or be introduced to Matt through ACON. So I've had this idea for many years. Everybody thought I was mad. And then when I was telling them about ACON, because I went back to work at ACON in August last year, and I was telling them that this is what I want to present to community as what I think would be a great idea for World Pride. And they were like, well, Matt's sister's baby mama's cousin, brother, something like that, we all family at ACON, is this person, Matt. And then showed me some of the work. We met up in Redfern, like on Redfern Street, had a coffee, had a yarn, and, you know, this is the idea. And so that's how the idea came about, and Matt and I linked up. And then during the holidays, Matt was down on Yuin Country, and he took these photos of a gum tree, and we set that off to the printers, and that's actually Gari's snakeskin is photos, and Gari is a Durga language from Yuin Country for snake. So that is why, and because I'm a proud Yuin woman, that is why she's Gari, and she from Yuin Country.
So Gari means, sorry, does it mean skin? Gari,
snake.
Snake. Oh, snake. Gari. Mm. And G-A-R-I?
Yeah, G-A-R-R-I.
Gari. Ah, beautiful.
And it's pronounced like curry, you know, like gari.
Gari.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's how she came about.
And, like, did you have it, the photograph obviously inspired the skin.
Mm-hmm.
So has it been kind of printed onto the surface here?
Yeah, so it's been printed onto material, 3D print onto the material, rainbow. I can show you videos, but I'm trying to explain it so that we can...
No, I'm getting it.
So it's printed on and then we just wrap it around. And it's like Velcro because once the inflation of her is done and the hoops that with the poles that we carry her up with, they can all be packed down and packed away and then we can travel it. So I plan on traveling her around the state to other prides for World Pride, just so that, you know, there's other mob in different communities that can't be in Sydney, but there are other prides where we can take her there and then they can be a part of it and say that they actually march with Gari for World Pride is my vision. Mm-hmm. So
I can almost like a Olympic what do they call torch, them? Yeah, yeah, like, well, like an Olympic mascot, you know, like those. Got to have a mascot. So the idea of the rainbow serpent, I mean, is a fascinating one because many of us have origin stories. Our stories go back to the rainbow serpent carving the country, you know. And so,
and that was the reason.
Yeah.
That was the reason behind the idea. Is what is one of the dreaming stories that we have that is common that you know, encapsulates all of us and that we all have some kind of connection to, and it is the rainbow serpent. So and rainbow being part of LGBTIQ.
I've never made that connection.
Right? Like, and that's what makes it even more powerful. Is that she represents, you know, not only culture but the intersectionalities of us as well, you know, when it comes to our sexualities. So it's just like perfect story, World Pride, you know, like put that on the map, like our dreaming stories, our culture, but also our intersectionalities of our sexualities. So
talking to Sue Pinkham just earlier, and the just going back through the history of, you know, Aboriginal our participation in the Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras, and she was talking about, like, one year their presence was derided by people in the black community for being present and for attaching our kind of culture to, you know, what they said was something wrong, something they couldn't agree with. So there's always been a kind of conservative, in every community there's a conservative part of the population who say that we're wrong, and within our community, you're homophobia. So how do we how have you counteracted that kind of, you know, black on black homophobia?
You know, coming from a younger generation, but, you know, the children's generation of the activists who were kicking in the doors for us to have seats at the table. You know, I publicly came out when the Deadly Brother, Chock, wanted to talk about Redfern Nows, Kirk Pages.
Anthony Mundine.
You know, I spoke to Joseph Clark back when Anthony was saying that, you know, there was no homosexuality within culture. And I was working for Queer Radio at the time with as the Young Black and Deadly youth coordinator. And so I was like...
in the middle, yeah, in the thick of it. Yeah.
Like, who is this influential black man to talk about what people don't have the... You know, we're born this way. We really are born this way. And I was working with the Deadly Daryl Sibisato. And, you know, his famous words, which I just take with me, is... I want to know what his phone number is to the ancestors so that I can ring them too and find out what I need to know. Because how does he even know? He wasn't there. It's not like, you know, there was men's business, there was women's business, and those oral stories weren't handed down, nor were they recorded as to what really happened. So I actually came out and spoke out about Chock's responses to homosexuality and and culture and young people. That year we dedicated our Mardi Gras after party to him that Daryl and I worked on, and we called it Chalk Rainbows that year. Still got the poster, it's amazing. But yeah, we thought, here you go, bros, we love you. So that's pretty much how I nobody can take away my culture, because that's something that my parents have given me, and my ancestors, and my sexuality is mine because I was born this way, and I'm going to be proud about it all, because that's all of who I am. We talk about it so often, especially within our queer world, around being your most authentic self. Well, this is my most authentic self. Try me. Try take it.
I'm glad that he seems to have quietened down. He's just one voice. I guess he's an expressing an opinion, which we know exists. But the less time I spend thinking about it, the better. I just need to, I always think, I wish I had a comeback. You know, if we had a comeback, Sibbo's, the phone line to the ancestors, because you can't say that. You can't say there was no practice of homosexuality in our mob. It's unreasonable. It's beyond belief that could be the case, because humans have practiced their kind of sexualities in all kinds of diverse ways throughout history for all time. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I just sometimes wish I had a comeback to the Anthony Mundines of this world.
Yeah.
What's your comeback? If you had one, what do we say?
Well, how do we know? For me, I remember saying to Anthony back then, and it was probably pretty ignorant of me.
You had contact with him about it?
No, I didn't have contact with him. I just did a interview with Joseph Clark, ABC, in response to it, as the Young Black and Deadly coordinator for Queer Radio and a lesbian woman. But yeah, I mean, it's even written in colonial history in regards to when they did get off the ship, there was men in dresses, there was, because they spent months on a ship together, and, we can't, just because we don't have it written that it was there, we don't choose this lifestyle. So how do we know that it wasn't there since Dreamtime? Like, I just don't get it. So,
and we can't trust them. I'm talking about the colonial sources to write us into the story, because they were writing from a profoundly homophobic culture, which responsible for all kinds of patriarchies and oppressions. That why would we trust them with that information? There's also all kinds of compelling evidence that men and women enjoyed their own sexualities in all kinds of expressions. And I've even heard sometimes the feather feet, the men who are generally men who were empowered with a certain vision in the community and trusted magic people, possibly also lived this other kind of life, were not ever heterosexual or homosexual. There's recent definitions, but yeah, there's other ways of kind of expressing sexuality. We don't always need to have a, they always say, if it's not in traditional culture, then it's not Aboriginal. And if it wasn't practiced traditionally, then it's not Aboriginal. It's like, we adapted, we made stuff up.
And that's it. Like, we often say that we are the most evolving culture ever, because we are the oldest, but yet we're still here. We're still living through a cultural lens. We're still practicing cultural law. We still practice cultural kinship. Like, these are practices of our culture that has always been there. Why is that still a thing? But homosexuality is, and it doesn't make sense even to the dumbest person, I think. So yeah, I don't even think that having a rebuttal around it is even an issue anymore. It's just continuously living your best life, your most authentic self.
And on that other thing of these twin forces of homophobia and racism, and in thinking about it as a queer black man, those things working against me at all times, and being conscious of them and living to counteract them, how much force do those things exert in your life? I mean, racism is powerfully present and immediate and urgent and always in our faces. And homophobia for me is something very similar. But yeah, how do you negotiate both of those things, knowing that in some gay and lesbian spaces you're going to encounter racism?
Look, encountering racism, one of the most recent and biggest events would have to be Christmas last year, going into Strawberry Hills Hotel, looking for work colleagues that I couldn't find. I lost along the way. We was meeting there for lunch. I wasn't sure whether or not we had a reservation. And the bartender, must have been a manager, was asking me what my reservations were. And I was like, I don't know. I'm not sure. Leave me alone. I've got this sorted. I'm grown. And she kept harassing me with trying to get information as to what I was doing there. And when I said, look, is there anybody else that you could help? Like, because I'm good. I'm just trying to find my colleagues. I'm good. And she turns around and her response to that was, that's it. I'm not serving you any alcohol today. You are to leave right now or I'm calling the police to have you arrested and removed. That was the Friday the 16th of December. And I was there with, like, ACON's a predominantly queer organisation.
This is 3 months ago.
Yeah.
Three months.
Yeah, 3 months ago. You know, on the doorstep of World Pride, you know, one of Sydney's biggest money-making events that Strawberry Hills probably won't be able to get anything out of now, because I'm following it up with an anti-discrimination clause. We're letting community know not to attend there. It's not a safe space for not only mob, but I think that it's also not a safe space for queer mob. But, you know, for me, I look more and present more as a hetero woman, I think. I'm very much black presenting. I do look like a black woman. But what does a lesbian look like, you know? A pretty black woman? I don't know. I don't know, you know. So I just continue to be me and take everything as it comes. It's not, I don't go out there continuously being the angry black woman that I often get painted with, because I'm quite assertive.
Assertive isn't angry, you know, and people just aren't reading you correctly.
Yeah, exactly. But that's probably the main thing that I get painted with, is being an angry black woman, because I am quite vocal around, you know,
what you will put up with and what you won't.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I did that because, you know, for me growing up, the only representation of a staunch black lesbian woman is Annie Sue, for me, Annie Sue Pinkham. You know, there's Annie Laura Sabantino, but Annie Laura, you know, she was in nursing and she looked quite humble, Annie. You know, but that's pretty...
A role model in a different way.
Yeah, role model in a different way. But, you know, the only one was Annie Sue that I can honestly say that I saw that, yep, that's staunch black auntie. Yeah. So that's why I do it too, because there are so many more young people that need to be able to see that and see themselves within me as well. So that's why I continue to do it. Because we've still got to break down barriers, you know, even within our own mob, around patriarchalism, you know, and misogyny that is there as well for black women.
Yeah, there's nothing harder to be, I don't think, in the world than an Aboriginal woman.
Mm.
I'm yet to hear of a group in society who experiences this, the same amount of trauma and responsibility, and those things never seem to change from generation to generation. So I always feel for my sisters, because like, oh, gee, wow, they've got to put up with a lot.
Mm.
Men can get away, black fellas can get away with, black men get away with a lot. But it's the women who are often charged with responsibility for keeping culture alive and telling stories and keeping it all up here, and then also raising the next generation. There's no greater power and responsibility.
Yeah. And then in saying that too, though, our men are also the most targeted when it comes to systemic society.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, and then our women do come in for protection. You know, we're the first ones there with big bundy for them, you know, like on the front line, you know, like, But that's the way that our...
Very generous of you.
But that's the way that our culture works, you know, like our cultural structure works like that, you know. Because we are the bearers, we are the mothers, we are the, you know, so that protection for... I'm definitely like that when it comes to my brothers and my nephews and stuff, you know, for me. And it's kind of like with my daughter, you know, like and I'm only thinking about it now that I actually do put a bit more responsibility on her to be a staunch independent self, because like at the end of the day, that's all you got is you. But then yet, you know, with nephews, I'm like, come here, auntie, I'll give you a big hug.
Yeah, the women tend to look after the boys, and like boys are very, not special, but because they're not you. I mean, I look after the girls because I think the girls are not like me, and I feel more empathy for them.
Mm.
I mean, I might know exactly what the boys are going through, but so, hey, give me them. The girls. Yeah, the girls is where I empathize most strongly with the girls, because I'm thinking, they've got to do so much. I know we haven't really kind of covered history in a way that's kind of comprehensible to other people, but I guess where are you at now? And I know we're in World Pride, and this seems to be dominating everyone's thoughts, and you're very, very busy with all those projects and bringing this dream alive. But in terms of where you are in your life, where are you?
I'm living on the block with my partner. I've been with her 5 years this year, raising her nephew, her 17-year-old nephew, you know, working in one of my dream jobs for my community, and just taking day by day is where I'm at these days. But yeah.
Hey, look, thank you so much. It's been really good to meet you. But there's one thing I want to do before I finish, and that is we're broadcasting a whole section of these oral histories on ABCRN. I'm the editor of Indigenous Radio, so I'm in charge of Away and Speaking Out. And what I've offered to my team is these reflections that people have on this idea of pride. So if I could, I'd ask you to introduce yourself again, and then just, if you can, speculate out loud or just muse with me on the idea of pride. Is that okay?
Sure, yeah. I'll try.
So Jenny Jane, introduce yourself, and what has pride mean to you?
Walwani, my name is Jenny Jane, proud Wiradjuri Walbunja woman from the Yuin Nation. What pride means to me is to be comfortable in being your most authentic self and to be unapologetic about it as well. That would be my, in a nutshell.
Were you taught pride? Were you taught by, there's elders who've taught us how to be in public and how to move in the world as responsible blackfellas? But was there someone whose example has led you to, you know, your own kind of idea of pride?
I wouldn't say there was somebody that's taught me how to live in pride, but watching my dad navigate, you know, and being the advocate and the staunch, unapologetic person that he was.
And your father was Uncle Kevin Smith, the actor.
Yeah, so dad being, you know, the actor, he was the bar manager / bouncer of the Empress Hotel, which was a famous, you know, Black Panther movement. And
so right here in Redfern, where we are today, just up here on the corner.
Yeah, literally just around the corner. I tell people that that's how I learned to play pool. I used to be there while he was cleaning up and fixing up in the day. So we would be at the pool table cleaning up, because I play pool with my left hand. I'm a right-handed person. I say that I learned how to play pool before I learned how to write. I don't know how true that is. I don't think it is. But, you know, it's a good yarn. And, you know, watching him be unapologetically himself, and that's why I think I am the way that I am. But I didn't have anybody else that was, like, teaching me what pride is. I just knew that I wasn't going to allow anybody to dim my light.
I guess, the child of an actor is going to learn how an actor walks in the world and occupies space. Sometimes we express our lack of pride in ways in our physical body. So I guess you're kind of born with it, because he's like, you know, proud black man, but also someone who knew how to move in the world, like physically and in other ways.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, you know, there's watching him, being backstage on many of his plays, seeing the people, going to dinners, going to opening shows, and being around all those people growing up, you know, I think that's probably also what encouraged me to be me.
Do you ever feel like there's a I guess there's an equation every day that you wake up with, and sometimes you feel 100%, sometimes you feel 50%, and in that equation, sometimes I feel a lack of pride in myself. So, I guess my body, you know, projects that into the world. Are there days when you just don't you don't have it? You don't have that the juice that you need to be proud? Because say like you know something with the when our young people die. I'm thinking of Cassius Turvey here. I'm thinking of when our men die in jail in unexplained circumstances. Or there are times when I just don't feel proud.
Definitely, you know, like those times when it's like, fucking, are you serious? Another one. Like it's just, yeah, you know, like really, some days it's like I can't do this. I cannot face the world. I've been let down again. I don't have the energy. I don't have the fight. I don't have my cup not even half full, you know, and then there's days where I'm like, but there's still more to do. Today was one, after Fair Day yesterday. you know, love Fair Day, love what we're doing, but there's just, you know, that background noise and background blackfellow politics that is happening that then deflate you, you know, like it deflates your spirit. And there was things that have been happening where it's just like, yeah, I was deflated yesterday. Didn't really feel like it today. And then,
Sorry to hear that, because you should be in your pride.
Exactly.
It's world pride.
And it's only the start. And, you know, it wasn't until like, I think it was about 12 o'clock where I was like, nah, you know what, there's so many more people out there that need to see this. And, you know, it's not about me. It's bigger than any of us. So let's get this job done. Let's do it right.
And you talked about earlier when we were speaking, you talked about visibility. And, you know, pride is okay, but it has to be also part of it is visibility. Mm. And being visible so that others know that you can be who you are. Mm, I mean, for me, pride and the parade, the Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras parade, has always been about freedom. And we're experiencing our freedom, but we're saying to everyone else in the world, you have freedom here, in your body to be who you are, in any kind of diverse sexuality or expressions of yourself. It's all about freedom.
Mm. Exactly, and we are lucky, you know, we are lucky here in Australia that we can and do have the opportunity to be free and be unapologetically our most authentic selves with the person that we love. And, you know, that's why I've got to keep going, you know, because it could be worse.
And you have a daughter who you're very proud of. Mm. How do you instill pride in the next generation as a young mother? You know, you raised her alone and as a single mum. How did you, and you were complimented the other day on her, on the way she conducts herself, you know, with respect for elders. So how do you teach it to the next generation?
Continuously doing that, you know, like, and the more you teach others, well then they're going to go out and teach more, you know what I mean, like, because then that's how they move in the world, and that's how we can actually change behaviors if there's more people coming from a place of love and understanding with empathy.
And what are your wishes for World Pride being, you know, that you're making, you're with ACON and making the First Nations float, which will lead the parade, but I guess the legacy, there has to be some legacy of World Pride. It can't just be some days in February 2023 and March 2023 that just disappear into the ether. What are the legacies of Pride, do you think? How do we continue maintain the momentum and keep it going beyond just these days?
Well, that's what I'm saying about the travelling serpent. Mm. We've taken her around, you know, to each of the prides.
Just to recap, Gari is the rainbow serpent that's going to lead the parade.
Yes.
co-designed with Matt Stegg, the mm-hmm. brilliant artist, imaginative, creative person. Gari.
Mm. And she's also going to be leading the World Pride March over Sydney Harbour Bridge as well. So, you know, travelling her, I think, will also create the legacy, because in that travelling segment with her too is where we want to talk about healthy relationships and how better health services can, well, especially ACON, can service our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities throughout the state. Is also my legacy that I hope to leave with, that is talked about forever more than anything.
You also talked about other prides, and I think you meant other celebrations of pride, you know, events at Broken Hill, Alice Springs, yes. Taking the idea of pride beyond the centre of Sydney, where perhaps it's more, you know, expected that we're going to be able to talk about pride, but people in rural and regional areas maybe don't experience pride. So the idea is to travel Gari, this rainbow serpent that you've conceived of, all around, to just encourage for it to become a mascot mm-hmm. For pride all over the country, not just here in Sydney.
Yes, that's exactly it. That's the plan. And do that with ACON and doing, you know, health messaging and ensuring that our mob are having safe parties and safe sex and are well versed on healthy love.
Hey, Ginny Jane, thank you so much. Happy World Pride, if that's what we say, but, you know, happy Mardi Gras and all that. And thanks so much for making time for me today. I know how busy you are.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.